On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In Britain, it's commonplace. Security cameras, surveillance cameras everywhere. Some now even shout at you if you misbehave. The average Londoner is caught on maybe 300 surveillance cameras a day. Now the bug is catching in the USA. Baltimore, Chicago, Philadelphia, all getting camered up. Thousands of new surveillance cameras headed into Lower Manhattan. Terrorism fears are driving the move. Big Brother will be watching. But does it really work, and is it worth the loss of privacy? Up next on Point, the craze for security cameras and tasting life in the surveillance nation. We'll hear in a few minutes from top surveillance experts on both sides of the effectiveness and privacy debates. But first, joining me from New York is Nick Thompson, senior editor at Wired magazine. He's been following surveillance trends and technology. Nick, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Well, good. So where's the big push coming from, and what's the volume look like? How much of this stuff is going in?
It's huge. It's going in all over the country. It's going in small cities. It's going in median cities, big cities, and New York and Lower Manhattan. It's going to be massive. In 1.7 square miles, they're going to have more than 3,000 cameras. That's the area below Canal Street in Lower Manhattan.
Now, maybe 1,000 of these, the cities, another couple thousand put up by private business, but all wired together so that the police can watch from all 3,000 of those.
Right. So what's going to happen is that some of the cameras will be mounted on poles, for example. Some will be hidden. There'll be fake pizza trucks driving around Lower Manhattan with cameras on top that you would never know about. And then there'll be feeds coming from companies that already have surveillance systems set up. And they use their surveillance systems internally right now, but what will be different is that the feeds will be sent directly to the New York Police Department.
Now, this is also a kind of a coordinated system. These are sort of smart cameras, right? Even if they're not being monitored by a human, they will notice if, let's say, a particular vehicle keeps circling the same block. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. That's the whole idea, and that's what makes this New York system different from everything else used throughout the world. What they say is, look, 3,000 cameras, you can't possibly have people watching all them. People, after you watch a surveillance camera for about 2 hours, you're useless anyway. So it's all going to be software-based. They're going to have software that analyzes all of the streams coming in and says, hey, look, there's a car that's circling a block. Or look, there's an abandoned knapsack. Oh, or look, it's an August day and there's somebody wearing a long coat. So the key about whether this will work is whether the software works and whether the software can effectively pick out the real threats from all of the information it's getting.
So it's depending on software. It's amazing, though. I mean, they've also got, roadblocks that will be ready to swing out and block or trap cars if they spot something they think is suspicious.
Right. So if the New York City Police Department determines that there's a real threat and there's something, you know, terrible about to happen, they could well turn all the lights in Lower Manhattan red. Cars will all stop. They'll put up a roadblock so nobody can flee, and then the cops will rush in. At least that's the idea. I mean, this is very dangerous stuff. You don't want to raise a roadblock and hit somebody's car. I mean, then that would take away all the political support for this program.
Right.
But the most important thing to remember about this is that most cameras are used to collect information after a crime has been committed. That's what we've seen before. The whole point of the New York City cameras is to do it in real time, to be able to stop the terrorist or the criminal before the bad thing happens. The idea is that a terrorist is going to blow himself up anyway, or may well want to blow himself up into the Freedom Tower. So you have to stop him before he does that. It doesn't have any effect, or it has very little effect, if you can see who it was afterwards.
He doesn't care, or she doesn't care, if her face is on a camera somewhere, if the deed is done.
Right.
London has been the big model here. With the IRA bombings years ago in the early 90s, they started pouring in like crazy. 4 million surveillance cameras around the relatively small UK at this point. And I'm reading here, Britain's caught on camera maybe on 300 cameras a day just in the process of their ordinary life. What does that example tell us about how it works if you put cameras everywhere? Do people accept it? Does it really lead to greater arrest or deterrence rates?
Well, a couple of interesting things we've learned from London. First of all, it does have a great effect on finding people after they've committed a crime. That's how we found the London subway bombers. When terrorist attacks have happened in London, they've been able to find people on footage very quickly. they haven't been able to stop these perpetrators, but who knows whether the fact that all the cameras exist has deterred other criminals. Mm. What we've also learned is that people in Britain are accepting. There hasn't been a real public outrage against these cameras. However, America is very different culturally, so it's going to be much harder politically to implement all of these programs.
I'm reading about cameras in the UK now that even have a shout capacity. If you're doing something misbehaving, they'll shout at you. Stop that.
Right. Please move that car from the curb. New York is not going to be doing that. I talked to somebody in the department the other day, and he said that actually he'd been told to move his car while recently visiting in London, and they didn't have that plan, but who knows? Maybe they'll implement it, too.
How far do you think we might go as a country? 4 million in the UK, that the equivalent would be many, many, many tens of millions here, I guess. The Department of Homeland Security has requested billions in recent years for these cameras, and a lot of mayors and police chiefs are putting their hand up. Is this a done deal? Are we on the rails already? Is there an active debate about how far we should go?
There isn't that active a debate. There's somewhat of an active debate, and I hope I'll be able to hear the rest of it, you know, the rest of this show.
Yeah.
I think we're going to go very far. There are a couple of trends at work here. One, you know, we're scared. Two, cameras are becoming much more effective. It's much easier to store data. Lenses are getting better. And perhaps most important, the software that allows you to sort through images is getting better, right? There's still a lot of things that computers can't do. Like, computers aren't very good at telling this is person A and this is person B,
right.
But computers are getting much better at it. Computers aren't very good at saying, you know, there's a green backpack in this image, but computers are getting much better at doing that. So as these trends continue, as data storage gets better, as internet connections get faster, as computer video searching gets better, there's going to be even more and more and more reason to use these cameras. And there are a lot of risks involved that could slow this progress or slow this trend. But I think the overall point is this is happening now. It's going to happen much more quickly. We've got a lot coming down the road.
Nick, when surveillance enthusiasts and technical enthusiasts look at this, where do they see the technology going ultimately? How smart, how thorough could the technology get it, and with what kind of features that would help security forces sort out threats?
Well, I mean, I think ultimately if you look way down the road, you could start reducing the number of police officers, and you can have a lot more done electronically and through cameras. I think what people are seeing sort of the 5 to 10 years out, what they would like to see are cameras that can really identify criminals, that you can say, you know, Abu Musab Zarqawi has, you know, 3 centimeters between his eyes or
so
whatever.
Face recognition.
You can put an image of him, mm-hmm. and then you can identify him. That would be one thing that would be fantastic. And then I think it's just going to be what we're going to be looking for in the next 5 years is incremental progress in the software. Software that can identify a stray backpack, you know, 50% of the time to 99% of the time.
Or identify someone with the long coat or someone whose gait of walking is odd because they're weighed down bizarrely.
Right. I mean, the human eye processes so much information. It's absolutely incredible when you think about all that you're seeing at one point and what's suspicious and what's not suspicious. Should be looking at that person. Should be looking at that wall. Should be looking at that reflection. You see it all and you have instinct. And humans are better at understanding what situation is dangerous than computers are right now. However, computers are getting a lot smarter a lot quicker. So I think they'll start taking on many of these tasks.
It is an amazing prospect, and it's underway already. Nick Thompson, senior editor at Wired Magazine, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me here.
I want to turn now to Gary Lafree, director of the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Response to Terrorism, funded by the Department of Homeland Security. He joins us from College Park, Maryland. Mr. Lafree, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
We're going to hear some real skepticism about this whole move today, but you are a supporter, an enthusiast. Why are you for a lot more camera surveillance in this country?
Well, I guess enthusiast might be a bit strong. I mean, I very much agree with the previous speaker, Nick Thompson, that this is a question of balancing security and civil rights. But this is certainly an area that I think has a lot of promise. And as you've already noted, London and the UK in general are sort of poster children for experimenting. And there's just a variety of ways that I think CCTV, closed-circuit television, mm-hmm. makes some sense. You mentioned the deterrence capacity, the fact that in some situations you can actually observe what's going on and then deploy police rapidly and, mm-hmm. and more effectively. There's, Nick mentioned the investigation, that there's pretty good evidence that the cameras have been very useful, for example, in uncovering and investigating the foiled plots in London.
And the plots that succeeded, sadly, we saw the faces of those guys headed down into the subway with the backpacks on their backs.
Exactly right. And also, I guess, criminologists have known for a long time that the more you have sort of what are called capable guardians out there, the more people think there's a chance they're going to be observed committing a criminal act, the less likely they are, in fact, to do it. So there's some pretty good theory behind it. The results have been, and actually it's an area where the British have done a lot of research, and the National Institute of Justice in the United States has done a fair amount, too. And I'd say it's not a magic bullet, not a panacea, but there's good evidence that it can be effective, particularly in the area of deterrence, and particularly with property crimes. There's much less information on what New York is attempting, where it's actually used for prevention. I think, as Nick referred to, the real cutting edge in terms of balancing security and civil rights is likely to be in this emerging area, though, of face recognition, where you're not just doing surveillance, but where there's software that's predicting whether someone is a dangerous person or is fitting into some sort of a database.
But Gary, do you think this can really grow in our culture? It wasn't that long ago where this was kind of the definition of a civil liberties nightmare, Big Brother watching all the time. We associated that with the Soviet state, with totalitarianism.
Absolutely. And I think this is where, you know, in a democracy, you're constantly balancing security and civil rights.
We're joined now from Columbia, South Carolina, by Matthew DeFlem. He's an expert on terrorism, counterterrorism, crime control, associate professor of sociology at the University of South Carolina, author of Policing World Society. Matthew DeFlem, thank you very much for being here.
Hello, Tom. Good to be with you.
You are generally critical of this big move to massive surveillance. Why?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, for a number of reasons, and actually some of them relate to what has been said before in terms of, let's say, the practical impact of those security systems, it's really not altogether clear what they accomplish. Because, for instance, to say that security surveillance systems, that they deter crime, I don't think that you can say it in such an unqualified sense. Rather, they will deter some crimes, or they may deter some crimes from taking place in certain areas.
Car theft down in London, because thieves know they're very likely to be seen taking that car and tracked as they drive around with the license plates being watched.
Yes, but what's going to happen with other crimes? You know, if somebody is let's say, willing to commit a criminal act, they may be deterred from committing that particular act. Suppose, for instance, that you know that a car has an alarm system attached to it. You will not steal that car, but you may just go to another car. Suppose that you know that security systems are very highly concentrated in one particular area. What will happen in other areas? So I think to some extent, it's not quite clear if it deters crime as if it deters a certain kinds of crime happening in certain areas. So you would actually have to fortify, you know, the entire nation, which I think in Britain and the United Kingdom has taken place to some extent. But then, of course, you're going to run into an entirely different set of issues in the United States where, you know, as one of the previous speakers indeed said, where culturally sensitivities are very, very different, and actually where an entire where all the issues that relate to criminal justice to effective policing systems are very, very different. So I think the argument that I've heard a couple of times before is, well, some of it works clearly in the United Kingdom. Let's also do it here. Mm. But then you just take one element of security systems in the United Kingdom and then transpose that one element to the United States.
You mean just the cameras everywhere?
Yeah, but you don't really know what that means in the context of our society, you know, and in our culture.
Well, what's the difference? Do they have some other auxiliary activity around the cameras that we would not?
Yeah, for instance, actually, police systems in the United Kingdom and the United States are very, very different. In the United States, you have a very much decentralized approach, very kind of a community-oriented policing system. Like the most typical expression of that, of course, is the famous Bobby, who is an unarmed officer. So you have much more, it's kind of more of an integrated system whereby... whereby the distinction, the distance, if you will, between police and citizen is a lot smaller than it is in the United States. In the United States, you have obviously the presence of guns, of weaponry, not only on the part of criminals, but also on the part of law enforcement. So you have a much more a fortified force.
But we saw how quickly the British were able to track down the unsuccessful intended bombers recently. I mean, still, the Jeep, what was it, some kind of Comanche or whatever it was that went into the airport in Scotland, it did get in there, but they were on it in no time, and the cameras seemed to be an important piece of that.
Well, true. I mean, I'm not arguing against all cameras at any time. I mean, for one, because that would be an impossible argument. You know, you would just never that wouldn't be possible at all anymore. However, I also want to qualify the role of the cameras in these investigations because it makes a lot of assumptions. First of all, you assume that there couldn't have been successful investigations without the camera. There is also a lot of other forensic evidence. Also,
yep.
Once a person is detected on a camera, that's not enough to convict that person at all. So you still need a lot of other evidence. And actually, just recently, a jury in the United Kingdom didn't reach a verdict on a number of people that were caught on camera because the pictures were too grainy. So the police said, those are the people, you can see it. Well, you don't quite see it quite clearly. And not to mention, of course, in the United States, we've had a few experiences with crimes caught on camera,
yep.
Not security cameras, uh-huh. But, you know, everyday people. And look at all the debate that we've had around that. You know, the Rodney King incident was probably the most famous one. Like things, or recently a person who, a police officer who shot a person who had served in the military. And, you know, and all those certain things.
But that
things
brings a kind of transparency, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Doesn't it? I mean, we've welcomed a lot of that casual video. Matthew DeFlem, hold the thought. Gary LaFrie, I want to come to you on this issue of how far we may go with this. We're a much bigger country than the UK. On the other hand, we have concentrated urban areas, certainly. And I'm reading here about towns right down to relatively small towns who are looking to put this in everywhere. Do you expect that, I don't know, 10 years from now, we're going to have, you know, the unblinking eye on every significant street in every city and town in this country?
Well, in fact, I think probably your listeners will be surprised at how much CCTV is already a part of our lives. I mean, ATMs, schools use them extensively. As you say, urban areas and even not so urban areas, prisons. And so, yeah, I think, like it or not, we're certainly moving in this direction.
We've all seen recently, like, the poor girl who came out of the Target and then was kidnapped and later killed in the parking lot. There's the girl and there's the alleged killer walking out right behind her, and we see that on TV.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I would agree with Matthew. It's not a panacea, but it's certainly, though, worth experimenting with. We're going to be experimenting with it. There's no doubt about that. Let's do the research, as I think the UK and the US have been starting to do. But I see other kinds of applications that make some sense. Like, for example, mass transit, other than air, is a very important part of our transportation system. It's something like 20 times more people travel by mass transit than by air.
So?
We have virtually no security. And you'd think for the nation's transportation system, CCTV might be something to look at. So, I mean, I think there are lots of applications, you know, they're not going to solve all of our problems. I think Matthew correctly points out it looks like there's greater evidence that it works with property crimes, auto theft in particular. But I'd say let's take a real look-and-see attitude, do the science to see if it's working, and then move forward.
It certainly brings a kind of almost weird vicarious life here. There was that ghoulish video caught on tape of the other bomber who was wrestling with his bomb in the subway in London, you know, trying to set it off right in front of a mother and child. We saw that later. I want to go to our listeners. John's calling from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Certainly during wartime, and we are in a war against terrorists. There have been recent bombings in other parts of the world. I believe that the right to protection of life and limb during wartime is certainly a minor sacrifice.
John, if that so-called war lasts a century, are you willing to give up your privacy for a century or more?
What? What lasted for a century?
If the so-called war lasts for a century, let's say 100 years.
That's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah?
That's ridiculous.
Oh?
That's ridiculous.
The long war? I mean, our government's talking about the long war.
Haven't we finished all other wars in much less time?
Amen. Absolutely, and yes. But this one, what, already twice as long as World War II? But we take your point. Under threat, bring it on, you say. Let's go to Steve in Acton, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Okay. Hi there.
Hi.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay, my concern is that scenario in Manhattan, I just see so many parameters go, you know, and so much information going into those computers, and so many decisions have to be made so quickly, and these people are monitoring the information are going to be able to shut down Manhattan with their red lights and gridlock, you know, anytime they think there's a risk. I mean, what's to say that that's not going to happen on a regular basis, cause chaos on a regular basis? And then you have the aspect of virtual terrorism, where these people can cause the computers to read a threat, walk around in a long coat, circle around the block again and again.
Leave a few golfing bags here and there on the sidewalk, yep.
And then just cause chaos and not even hold a bomb. It would be a virtual terrorist. And this could happen on a regular basis and paralyze Manhattan on a regular basis. I mean, what's to stop that from happening?
Well, let's ask the experts. Matthew DeFlem, what about it? Is the software good enough? Will it be good enough that it can really make fine distinctions without throwing everything into chaos, as our caller suggests, fears?
I would take some issue with with some of the technical capacities that are sometimes attributed to the technologies.
They're being talked about.
Yeah, and which, quite frankly, I also think is a selling point, because let's not forget that somebody is producing all of this machinery and is making an awful lot of money on this, too. Now, there's an entire private security industry sector behind all of this, which actually I also think is an alarming issue if you consider that the 3,000 CCTVs that are being planned in New York, that two-thirds of them are going to be privately owned. So we're going to have images of our doings that are going to be in the hands of private companies that somehow are also collaborating with police.
It sounds like a John Grisham novel just waiting to be written.
Yeah,
there.
So it's like, you know, because this is not socialized security care, right? Let's be frank about that, which is actually an important issue. And, you know, and obviously we're talking about it now, is that there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of debate about these issues. I mean, debate in the decision-making process itself of installing them. You know, the NYPD says, we think it's a good idea, and then it's like, oh, and everybody just has to follow. So there should at least be some, obviously, I hope, you know, a popular debate, but at least some political oversight and all of this, too. And so, and actually, in terms of counterterrorism and also one of the callers said in terms of war, indeed, you know, I would hope that at least that within this nation, we're only metaphorically at war with terrorism, and that in terms of terrorism as a crime control issue, that actually then, for me, the basic problem with surveillance is that it comes very late in the process of terrorist activities. Namely, it's only at the execution stage. We don't know anything about the planning, you know, the people that are, you know, rallying to commit terrorist activities. So we are waiting until the very, very final moment.
Does it breed laziness, a sense that, well, we'll catch it at the last minute, so we don't have to go out and get the intelligence?
Well, it's not so much laziness. You know what it is? It's a drift towards using technology rather than using people and relying on human intelligence and so on. Now, I'm not saying that there is no such work being done, because we know that there is. And actually, in that sense, what I think are the more spectacular arrests are not the arrests of the people that have been caught in the subways, but the people that have been caught during the planning stage.
Watching them casing the buildings, and of course we have seen that. Yeah. Let me take a call from Mason City, Iowa. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Basically, I was thinking about how the man said that the video equipment isn't advanced enough to actually do what the human eye can do.
Not yet, but it's rolling down the tracks.
Right, but I'm already thinking that we already have the human eye, and we already have enough people around for one person perhaps to watch another person. And so if instead of investing so much money into technology, they could just offer rewards for people to, say, turn in their family and friends if they thought they were doing something wrong.
So are you painting a dystopia for us, John? Are you saying we're going to turn into the snitch state?
See, that's what I'm saying. I mean, if you want to be watching people all the time, why not have other people watch other people?
Yeah, and there's the fear factor. John, thanks for your call. Gary LaFrie, you can hear it. There's that Native American skepticism in some callers, and on the other hand, you know, the sort of the bring it on voice in others.
Well, I think one thing that might draw somewhat of a line, I think it's an important legal line right now, is the Katz versus United States case. It's a 1967 case, and it basically says that one has a right to be free of government surveillance only when there's a reasonable expectation of privacy. In other words, if you're sitting on the 50-yard line at the Super Bowl, you probably do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So that at least gives you some perhaps clear thing. In other words, it's much more defensible to use these sort of security systems when you're in a clear public space than it is certainly in your own private homes.
But are we then going to define every street, public street, in every city and town in the country as a fair game for, you know, intimate surveillance? I mean, what was it? There was an incident during the 2004 Republican convention in New York. New York police using a lot of surveillance. You know, they end up filming a couple in an amorous embrace on a rooftop in Manhattan. That ends up on the web.
That's true. There are lots of gray areas, and I think, you know, in any democratic society, we're constantly dealing with the advances in technology and the implications. I think this public-private is just the beginning. I mean, frankly, as a citizen, I'm much more enthusiastic about CCTV in downtown Manhattan than if I were the mayor of Fargo, North Dakota. So I think there's a certain amount of, we have to put some risk into the thing, and again, evaluate security versus civil rights, and certainly not err on either of those two sides.
Let's take a call from Brett in Brighton, Massachusetts. Brett, you're on the air.
Hi. I want to know, how is the technology of these cameras going to be able to make the distinction between what's a dangerous behavior and what's just a different behavior?
Like what?
For instance, I have Tourette syndrome, mm-hmm. and so if I'm walking on the street in New York, am I going to have to be fearful that because of my tics, I'm going to be picked out by a camera as having a strange gait that could mean, you know, that I have explosives on me or
right?
That
so I'm your your Tourette's hits you, and the next thing you know, the SWAT team is on you. You're afraid.
Exactly.
Matthew DeFlem, what about it? I mean, are we too worried to wonder about distinctions like that? Brett's afraid that, you know, he's got Tourette's. Is he going to end up, you know, swooped up off the street?
Yeah. Well, it brings up an interesting issue, and actually that is that the technology, the camera, is records information very passively. It doesn't tell you the meaning of what it is that can be seen. And so what that means is that you still need humans to make sense of these images and to interpret them in a particular context. And you see, so that also actually, what that also brings up again is that once you have the security system installed, that doesn't solve all the issues. There has to still then be a lot of follow-up to it. You know, what is going to happen with all the recorded images? Who are all these people that you're going to have to employ to oversee this entire system, to interpret it, to look at all the tapes once something has occurred and so on? And so there is still, let's say, there is still a human element in all of this technology that you cannot engineer out.
Mm-hmm. Right now we're joined by somebody who's right in the thick of it from Chicago. Tony Ruiz is with us. He's acting director of the Office of Emergency Management, City of Chicago. He developed the city's network of security cameras, and it's pretty thorough at this point. Tony, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How many cameras does Chicago have up, private and public, wired into police at this point doing the job?
Combined, we have around 2,000 cameras.
And how many are government and how many private, Tony?
We have, we actually don't like to give those numbers out.
Okay.
But we do, it's almost 50-50.
Okay. And I know you've had them aimed at government buildings and train platforms and intersections, and I don't know, what are you watching? What do they watch?
You know, one of the things we do with our cameras, we're very versatile with the cameras. We monitor, high crime areas, assess traffic flow. You know, we coordinate emergency response anytime we have a fire, an incident with police. We also use them for, assessing, we have a lot of snow here in Chicago.
Sure.
Assessing snowfall. We have cameras that actually assess and actually use a laser that gives us a great grip rate on the, on bridges and stuff. So, storm damage.
So very practical kind of day-to-day things we might not think of. What about on the terrorism front? Is it key to your anti-terrorism policy in Chicago?
Yes. I mean, we placed a lot of cameras, especially in the Central Business District. That's where our critical, livelihood of economic livelihood of the nation is. So we kind of concentrated on the CBD, Central Business District. So we're actually testing analytics right now, and it's still...
Testing it on what? Sorry, Tony?
I'm sorry?
Testing it on what you said there?
Analytics.
Analytics, meaning?
Meaning that there's software applications that will address any erratic behavior of a person, walking or even dropping a bag. If somebody was to drop a bag,
does that look promising to you?
Oh, very promising. We tested several applications. And so we're working with some vendors right now. And once we find the right application for us, and so far it the applications out there are phenomenal. You know, we can address traffic flow, people. You know, if somebody moves, if we have flowing personnel, people flowing one way, and somebody moves the other way, you know, against the flow of, then it'll trigger an alarm, and we address it. Usually, that's good for like our airports.
If you had the money, how widely would you roll this out across Chicago? You've got 2,000 now. If money were no object, how many cameras would you like to have up?
Well, the mayor wants a camera on every intersection of the city.
So we're talking.
I mean, tens of thousands of cameras citywide.
And Chicagoans know he wants that. How are they responding? Are they saying, "Yeah, nail them up," or "No, we want our privacy"?
Yes, the public, they love the cameras. Anytime we move a camera, we get, you know, the public citizens are saying, "Well, what happened?" Sometimes we have mobile cameras we move around, and there are wireless cameras. So yeah, the public they love the cameras. They feel secure.
Mr. Ruiz, let me ask you, you're a security officer there, but you're also a citizen. Do you ever think, my gosh, this sounds like, you know, George Orwell in 1984? What if we got, I don't know, a government that started watching people for the wrong reasons? You know, do you ever worry about it as an American citizen?
No, you know, our staff, they're trained on the First and Fifth Amendment, and they know what, most of our cameras are, all of our cameras actually are in the public way. And we address that, you know.
But the public way is where we live our private lives very often.
Well, yeah, we're not shooting images. We're not shooting into the into windows or you know, into private homes. Mm-hmm. You know, public way, streets, you know, alleys. So it's been very positive for Chicago. I think we've actually solved some murders.
Wow.
We've contributed to hundreds of drug related arrests. You know, and it's been working.
Do you think Mayor Daley will get his way? Will you one day have them on every intersection?
I don't know if we need, you know, that many cameras, but yes, we're going to expand our network. We have a huge fiber optic network that we own. It's over 300 miles of fiber. We can address anywhere in the city. We can put a camera up, and we use some wireless technology also.
Well,
with that.
Well, there it is, right there from Chicago. You can hear it. It's happening. Tony Ruiz, Acting Director of the Office of Emergency Management for the City of Chicago. Mr. Ruiz, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me go to Frank in Columbia, South Carolina. Frank, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
I'm waiting here patiently, just waiting for the experts and everyone else to get through saying what they had to say.
Okay, lay it on us.
This is my deal. They should put 1,000,000 cameras around everywhere, resident homes, you name it, because I've been violated by, like, these little gangs that just crossed my property.
Mm-hmm.
I approached them, and next thing you know, one of my tires was cut on my truck. So I end up putting night vision cameras around my house. I have 8 cameras around my house.
And what do they do for you?
What they do is I'll be able to get a picture of something of someone tampering with my property that they should not, that they don't own.
Do you post a sign saying don't mess with me because you'll be on camera? I mean, how do they know? How's the deterrent factor work?
Well, it's deterrent. Matter of fact, I haven't had any problems since I put them up. They see the cameras out there. It's in view. Matter of fact, before I put the night vision cameras out, I use my digital camera and my camcorders, and that sent them a message. Then I put the night vision cameras up. So I think night vision cameras, whatever kind of CCTV system that you have, should go up around the whole world.
So you've got 8 of them at home, and you say let's put up millions around the world, and we hear the enthusiasm for it, Frank. Thank you for that call. Let me get one from Augusta, Georgia. Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I tell you, what bothers me about this issue is the catalyst for it is fear. If you, it's not too long ago we were disgusted by the Stasi of East Germany or the KGB of Russia for doing the same thing. And as long as it's done responsibly, because it's inevitable it's going to happen once this machine starts moving, we can't forget what used to bother us about the KGB's approach.
But you heard Tony Ruiz in Chicago, Adam, and he says, look, we're trained in the Constitution. We know how to use this correctly.
Well, I grew up in Boston, and I believe it was on the Blue Line years back. They tried to replace the police with cameras, and the gangs would drag people in front of them and beat them up. Perhaps it's going to work, but I'm still very skeptical, and we shouldn't forget why we're kind of there's anxiety about this issue.
Right, and the land of the free is a good phrase, too. Adam, thanks for that. Let me get one more from Boston. Benjamin, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, since this is such a large project that's going to affect the majority of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to get a chance to vote on it? I mean, are we going to get a say in the process, or is it just going to happen?
That is a very good question. Let me put it to my guests, and thank you for your call, Benjamin. Matthew DeFlem, do you anticipate, a legislative, stamp of approval being required for this, or is this just something that happens and it's inexorable and it's a done deal?
Let's say it will definitely expand. That's also what we heard from the caller in Chicago who is responsible for these systems, because a lot of it takes place at a municipal level. Mayors tend to be in favor of it. There is obviously, we're still in a 9/11 situation, and our culture is very much oriented these days towards increasing security systems rather than decreasing them. So, it sells well, if you will, although I would probably question somewhat what a person from Chicago said in terms of just saying that the public loves it. I would rather hear that being said by the public rather than by the official in Chicago who is in charge of installing these systems.
Well, it's interesting. I'm looking at a poll here, a Zogby poll done last fall.
Mm-hmm.
It says, overall, here's the question. Would you favor allowing these methods if it meant increased protection from terrorist acts? And they asked about allowing video surveillance of public places. 80% of Americans said they'd favor that. Now, it is interesting if you go on down, and that was 77% Democrats, GOP, Republicans, 87%, so more Republicans. If you go on down, Republicans were much, much more open to these kind of interventions in the poll. 62% of Republicans would accept regular roadblocks to search vehicles. 38% of Democrats. 60% of Republicans would allow random searches of cars. 37% Democrats. Monitoring telephone conversations, just to get a sense of what the American public is, monitoring your telephone conversations secretly, 56% of Republicans said in this poll, come on, sure, do it. Only 20% of Democrats. Gary LaFrie, there's quite a span, but also some readiness, 80% for surveillance. Don't you ever worry about it as an American citizen? What if we got a government that started using this in the wrong way to weed out, people with different view of politics or something?
Well, I think we certainly, in a democratic society, we want to be constantly vigilant about that, and we want to constantly be thinking about balancing these issues with civil rights issues. But it's interesting, I guess, if you take the old Orwellian image, it was one where you were essentially using government to keep private citizens in line. What's interesting about your callers, though, and I guess in the more complicated world we live in, is it can go the other way, too, that it can reduce citizens' fears in some cases. There's this project in Los Angeles involving MacArthur Park, which had this huge problem with drug deals going down all the time. The cops would come in, the drug deals would sort of trade off for a while and then come back again. And they've been experimenting out there with surveillance cameras using these super rugged, vandal-resistant cameras.
Okay.
And the initial reports is the neighborhood is very positive, and it looks like crime rates have dropped. So, I mean, in other words, it's a very interesting issue, because it's not just the fear that the government will overreach, but the fear citizens have of being victims of crime or victims of terrorist violence.
So fear itself can put a crimp in the life of freedom, no question about
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Let's take a call from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wonder when the cameras will preempt freedom of assembly and freedom of association. Since we have to have a permit for everything, the camera will just preempt that permit, preempt any assembly, any association. They take your photograph and you're on a permanent NSA list. Yes?
Yeah, well, history shows us that's not an unreasonable question. Matthew DeFlem, again, at the GOP convention in New York, I mean, police were swooping down on people as soon as, just a handful got together. I don't know if cameras were involved with that, but what do you think of John's concern?
Yeah, you see, that is obviously a basic constitutional issue, and that doesn't have to do so much with the basis of these decisions, whether we can take part in the decision-making process, but that has to do with the effects of, once we have these systems in place, are they going to be intrusive into our lives and in terms of privacy and so on, and to what extent will that take place? Because actually, the way Gary said before, in terms of the expectation, the reasonable expectation of privacy, but in an unqualified sense, privacy is always protected in some sense. If you're at a Super Bowl game, you don't have the sense of privacy that your image might be on ESPN, but you do have a sense of privacy in the sense that you don't think somebody's going to be watching you, for ulterior motives, for purposes that have nothing to do with the broadcast of the game or whatever it might be. The same token, if you have cameras at intersections in cities, you know, they may have a function, for instance, in terms of traffic safety, which I think is something that most of us will agree with. And obviously, if there's a criminal activity taking place, but there is so much other mundane, everyday actions taking place. And at that point, it becomes very difficult what these cameras are used for. The other thing I was thinking of is that if we think, for instance, in terms of counterterrorism, now suppose that certain advances have been made in those areas. Once that entire infrastructure is in place, it will be used and it must have a function to remain in existence, which typically it will do. So what is it going to be used for then, you know, if it is not for counterterrorism?
What do you think?
Well, I think that there's at least a potential that it might be misused. Actually, that relates me back to the person who was speaking on behalf of the city of Chicago, is that, you know, he didn't immediately tell you which ones were privately operated and which ones were operated by the city.
Right.
So it's like they can always, the people who manage these systems can always invoke a certain privilege, you know, to not communicate certain types of information, you know, but rely on us. We are not looking into your windows. I'm sorry, but I really don't think that is enough. You would want to have some oversight over what kind of activities are being registered with surveillance systems and what is being done with that information.
Let's go to Cedric in Nashville, Tennessee. Cedric, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The troubling thing to me is who's policing the policymakers? I mean, we're talking about true crime, and it's being portrayed to us behind the guise of counterterrorism and everything like that. Well, the whole premise for us going to war was a ruse. The Halliburton schemes and everything that we're finding out about the true criminals who are the policymakers.
Well, wait a minute. 9/11 came before the invasion of Iraq. I mean, terror did come to this country in a very significant way, and we saw it.
Well, I mean, that's true. But let's look at the whole reason that we're even in Iraq.
So,
I mean,
so you want to put the camera on Halliburton headquarters or I don't know, K Street in Washington or something?
Well, let's look at the true policymakers. These are the true criminals. If you can actually send over 50,000 United States citizens to Iraq, and we've had countless numbers of them die in this war, compound that by Blackwater and the amount of money that we've actually spent.
Cedric, our time is short, but we've got the perspective. Maybe you want to flip the cameras around the other way there. Gary LaFrie, I wonder if there may be some more technical sophistication that may help us with some of the civil liberties threats. I read about some new technology that would actually block out faces in this videotape until and unless there was real suspicion of criminal activity.
Well, Tom, actually, I think, you know, we're famous in the United States for putting lots of emphasis on technology, and I think we have a classic case here, as we've had many times in our history, where the technology is running ahead of our social and legal systems for dealing with it. And, you know, if you look, one of your earlier callers, for example, was concerned about having Tourette syndrome, and this would be identified as suspicious behavior. If you look at the applications so far, they've actually been pretty unsophisticated in a sense. Like the use of it at the Super Bowl in Tampa, they simply screened in people who had criminal records in the area and were looking for them coming into the game. So it wasn't like identifying suspicious behavior. That technology is probably a ways down the line, but it is probably coming. And so you're sort of seeing this bleeding edge, just like you're seeing in genetics and other kinds of areas that we're going to have to, as a nation and a democracy, deal with.
We may
time.
Need some new law to go along with that technology to keep things effective, but within boundaries that respect the spirit of our Constitution, no?
Absolutely, and in ways that we probably are not even imagining yet.
Boy, I've learned a lot in this hour. I'm imagining things I didn't not so many minutes ago, and I want to thank each of you for helping us do just that. Gary LaFrie at the University of Maryland, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Matthew DeFlem at the University of South Carolina, joining us from Columbia, South Carolina. Professor DeFlem, thank you for being here.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.